Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. And I'm about to give you some real anxiety. Are you ready? Are you ready for the sound? Listen to this. So you're probably freaking out as my phone is making all these noise and wondering if it's your phone that's making all these noise and thinking to yourself, oh my God, it's a text message. It's a DM. It's a God knows what. And that is because we live in a world where our devices have complete and utter control over us. They interrupt us at dinner, with our family, with our friends, everywhere, with emails, with text messages, with DMs. It's just constant. And we, as people, don't want it anymore. We're kind of fed up with it. We're sick of all of these things that are just kind of knocking on our door and annoying the hell out of us. So my guest today has gone through the same thing, but has actually come out of the other side with a solution. He is Ryan Holiday. He's the author of several books, and I'm very excited to welcome him back to the show. He came on about a year and a half ago when he had another book out about the media wars between Peter Thiel and Gawker. And his latest book is called Stillness is the Key, and it's about how to win in the battle against tech and the importance of stillness in our lives and leaving our devices behind and turning things off and, you know, essentially just how to win this war. So I'm very excited to welcome him to the show. So you've written a number of books. How many books is it now?
I think I've been saying 10. I haven't totally counted. I think it's between 9 and 10.
Okay, so the fact that you can't count is almost like, I think I have 8 kids. It could be 7.
Yeah.
We lost one in at Disneyland and may have gotten him back. But all right, so the thing that I find so fascinating about your books and the projects you've worked on is they're like all over the place. Mm-hmm. And this one actually could not have arrived in my mailbox at a better time.
Ooh.
Because... the book is called Stillness is the Key. I've been having a little bit of an existential crisis that I'm hoping you can walk me through.
Okay.
And help me out with. I work too much.
Yeah, me too.
And everyone's like, you need to meditate and you need to like stop and take a minute and be one with the universe. And I'm like, but I have this deadline.
Yes.
And that deadline and this deadline and whatever. So I want to first understand how you got to doing this book, and then I want you to help me.
Yeah, okay. So my books are all over the place. This one is sort of the third in a trilogy. I did Obstacle is the Way, Ego is the Enemy, and then this one. And they're all sort of philosophically driven books illustrated with historical stories about themes that I think are very important to where we are today. And so stillness is this, I don't think you're the only one that's like, I work too hard and things are too busy. You know, stillness is, I think, a thing we all know we need more of and have way too little.
I think it's also, just sorry to interrupt and then I'll stop talking, but it's not just that I work too hard and have too much going on and everything. It's that I feel like the universe we live in, the society and the world we live in today is designed to not allow you to be still. And it's you're at war with that.
Yes. No, 100%. Although, that's what I thought. And then as I was sort of researching the book and looking at it, it's also, this is a perennial problem of the human experience. I mean, in like 1500, Pascal says like all of man's problems stem from his inability to sit quietly in a room alone. So That was a little easier to do before Twitter or Facebook or, you know, email, or the fact that you could hop on a plane to New York City right now for like $150, right? Like that's those things certainly exacerbate the problem, but clearly it's always existed and it's always been really hard. And what I thought, I think when we think of that idea of stillness, we primarily think Eastern. And so like you're saying, people are like, oh, you should meditate. You have to be one with the universe. So we hear that as a solution, but we sort of turn away from it because it's very unrealistic.
Unrealistic in what way?
Well, you have a deadline you have to meet. You know what I mean? Like you do exist in the actual, like there is this in the Eastern philosophies, there is this sense that it's like detach from the world, like turn away from the world, just turn inward. That's all that matters, you know? And we all have mortgages and jobs and things. So I tried to think about this idea of stillness, not just from that perspective, but also see where does this occur in Western philosophy, because it's also a big theme in Christianity and in Stoicism and even in Epicureanism, this idea of like slowing things down, finding some peace, being calm, being really focused, being really deliberate, not living a chaotic life. It's not just from Buddha, you know, it's from across the spectrum.
And so was there a period in time in history where people did do this more, or was it always, has it always been like, you know, back in the 1500s, people like, I gotta go clean up the cow poop out there, and then I gotta milk the cow, and then I've got to deal with my 17 children when I just lost a blight, and you know, it's like,
yes.
Or I guess the question is, has technology, it has made it harder, but yes. But was there a point in time when people were able to do it and actually did?
Well, so I opened the book with the story of Seneca, and in one of his letters, he's basically like, he's sitting down and he's trying to write, and he just starts like cataloging all the noise that he hears. Like, there's a guy getting arrested down below. You can hear like vendors shouting. It basically sounds like one of those, you know, summer afternoons in New York City where you have to open the window because it's so fucking hot in your apartment. You know, like, yeah. And you're just like, but then there's the jackhammers and the car horns, and you're just like, this is not healthy, and how can any human being work in this environment? And Seneca's just sort of talking about like how we have to be able to cultivate some sort of inner stillness because the world is outside of our control. It's always going to be like this. And again, he didn't have to deal with car horns. So I think what you find is in the ancient traditions that like they were much more deliberate, much more conscious about this, and they were really working at it then, even though now we might think that that kind of life is just naturally still and quiet, and that good work just comes to you because you lived in Athens.
So before you started writing this book, were you being still, or were you kind of in the rat race like all of us?
I mean, I was in the rat race, and I still am in the rat race. I feel like it's, I know all my personal happiness and all my best work comes from that place. And yet I'm just sort of disappointed in how rarely it actually occurs. So I wanted to sort of like, how does one be a little bit more deliberate? How do you cultivate this? How do you access it? Because it's what we need. And then I think not just like you and I, like it's terrifying to me that like the people we rely on to make really important decisions, whether it's in business or in government, are sitting in their office and they have like Fox News just running quietly in the back. Like, how can anyone focus or think big picture when they're scrolling through their Twitter feed?
Well, it's interesting. I've been kind of in a war with my devices. So I remember at this point in time when I was so happy that I had iMessages on everything, on my iPad, on my phone, on my computer, and I've since completely deleted them.
Yes.
I no longer have allow updates on my computer. I no longer have notifications turned on my phone except for iMessages from certain people. Like it's still incredibly difficult.
Yes.
I had this moment I remember a couple of years ago when I got a message from someone that popped up on my phone, and I, you know, when you accidentally open your phone but you don't know, but then you go back to the home screen, you're like, wait, where's the message? And I spent like 20 minutes trying to find which app the message came from.
Yes.
And then it turned out it was like some, like, I don't know, Signal or something. It was like a it was spam or something. I don't even know what it was, but I was like, this is insane that I have these many communications. How have you changed the way that you interact with technology?
A bunch of ways. So I do. I don't really have any social media on my phone.
Do you use social media at all? Or?
I do, but I try to do it on my computer. So I have like Instagram on my wife's phone because you can't really use Instagram on. You can't actually use it on the desktop, so I use it on my wife's phone. So, like,
you're going to throw her under the bus for your stillness requests?
Yeah. So no, it's like if I want to post a photo, I can't just pull. I have to sort of save it up and do it in a batch, you know. And I can't just be mindlessly like if I post a photo, I'm not in a position to see how many likes it got every 8 seconds. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like creating some distance there, and then also people can't get in touch with me through it. I have a couple rules. So I go like emails for work, texts are for friends. So I try not to do any business on texts. So that way, like when I am checking texts, it's not stressful. It's for fun. And then the thing I started doing is I started with 10 minutes and I've worked my way up for an hour. I don't, and now many more than that, but I don't check my phone in the morning. So like,
what do you mean you start, how does that work?
So like what
so
I
you wake up.
So the first thing was I don't sleep with the phone in my room.
Where do you put it?
In the kitchen.
Okay. Do you check it before you go to bed?
Yeah, whatever. Like, so let's say I go to bed at 10 and then I wake up at 6. I haven't checked it for 8 hours.
And then do you, how long?
But I don't check it. So let's say I wake up at 6. I go like, okay, I woke up at 6. That means I can't touch my phone. I started, I was like, can't touch it till 6:10.
Huh.
And then I pushed it to 6:30. And then now I can very easily do an hour. Sometimes I'll be like, oh, it's lunchtime and I'm touching my phone for the first time.
And do you feel that you are missing out on anything?
I not only don't feel that I'm missing out, because I will go to my computer, like at some point I'm writing and maybe, you know, I'm seeing my email, but I don't have, like you, I don't, you can't iMessage me on my computer. But what I found that it's done is it's reduced my overall dependence on the phone. Like, because I'm not starting the day with it, it's not like a companion through the day. It's just a less significant figure in my life overall.
And do you work from home or do you?
I have an office, but I also work from home.
So when you're going through this kind of process of almost not divorcing, but separating from your devices, what changes in your life? Like, what is the thing that you have, do you read more books? Do you play with your kids more? Do you, you know, go and pick up the cow poop outside? Like, what is it that you do?
I do find that it increases the time or space to just like sit there while your kid plays with trains. And like, so you're doing that, right? You're not like, I'm on my phone while you're playing with trains. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I have a friend who used to do this, and his wife gave him a really hard time. It was like, you've got to stop being on your phone. He's like, I'm never on my phone. Like, I check it once in a while, but I'm not like sitting there on it.
Yeah.
So she woke up one morning as he got up with the kid, and she like literally filmed him for like 10 minutes from like this and showed it to him. And he literally was like, oh my God, I have a problem. And he since then has gone through the same thing you have. The thing that I struggle with is I have this anxiety of like, oh, what if there's an important email waiting for me?
Sure.
Or what if there's some breaking news that I have to like know about?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you deal with that?
I have the same anxiety, but it's never once proven to be true. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
it's true.
Like there really isn't anything that I've ever missed. And whenever I'm late to responding to email, like I get this, like sometimes, you know, you get random emails from people. I try to I basically star them in a folder in my email, and then I don't get to them till later. And it occurred to me, like, after doing this for a while, so I might reply to an email like 3 months late. Like, someone's like, hey, I'm thinking about quitting my job, what do you think? And I'll be like, oh, I don't think you should do that. I'll reply, and they're like, oh wow, I never thought you would reply, thank you so much. And it was like, I was feeling bad that I waited 3 months.
Yeah.
And they're like grateful that they got it at all. It's like, I probably could have waited a year. Like, so the pressure to reply is not from them. It's in my head.
So you in the book, you look at a lot of kind of the scientific aspect of all this and the thinking of, you know, Zen Buddhism and this, that, and the other. Talk us through, like, so what happens, what does the idea of sitting still actually do to us?
You know, it's interesting. I think when people hear the word stillness, they think meditation.
Yeah.
And I don't meditate. I really don't like it.
But you talk about people in the book that do.
Not really. I mean, I mostly am talking about, I tried at least in the book to be like, I mostly want to talk about ways to get stillness that does not require asking people to do a thing that like they've pretty overwhelmingly told us they're not going to do.
Got
do you know
it.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, look, it's probably better for your personal finances to keep a budget, but nobody keeps a budget, you know?
Like, tried, didn't work out.
Yeah. And so I kind of feel like meditation is like in a similar bucket. Like, I'm sure it's great, but like, so I'm like, okay, why don't we start by just like limiting the inputs that we have in our life? Why don't we start by, you know, like strengthening relationships in our life? Why don't we go for walks more often? Like, why don't we try to do a bunch of the things that don't require us to meditate that give us 80% of the benefits of meditating? And then maybe we'll be in a place where it's possible to sit. Cause I think it is interesting. Like, if you're one of these people who's like convinced that like your worth is tied up in your accomplishments, let's say, or you have some...
Doesn't everyone think that these days?
Or if you have these wounds from your childhood that you haven't gone to therapy and dealt with, right? I imagine you might have a 15 minutes of great meditation, but then you go back out in the world and it's sort of...
Well, that's what happened to me. I downloaded the Headspace app,
mm-hmm.
and it's great and I love it and I feel very calm in that moment. And then I go inside the house and the kids are screaming and beating each other up and the dog's barking. And it's literally like someone turned the volume down for 10 minutes and then they turned it right back up again.
Yeah. And it's certainly great to turn the volume down for those 10 minutes. I mean, I don't think there's any harm in doing it, but like, I think... Most a lot of the times, like it's we're the problem, you know. Like it's like whatever's sort of roiling up inside of us is why we don't have any stillness. And so, I'm not sure you can just.
Do you think that as we kind of look forward with technologies? So we created the notification,
yeah.
right? And it started. It's almost like a cattle prodder, right? Mm-hmm. Bright red in your face, like, hey, look at me.
Yeah.
Here's a message that doesn't mean that means nothing to
yes.
you. And then every app was able to send you a notification. And then the technological response to that was that you could turn off your notifications one
yes.
by one. Then you could turn them off. Then you could turn on the screen saving time where it says, hey, you've been on social media for 17 hours today. Maybe you should
yeah.
take a break. What do you think that the only solution to these problems is to come up with more technological solutions for most people? I mean, you,
yeah.
look, I think it's amazing that you don't check your phone for the first hour you wake up. I have a really hard time not doing that. I don't check it in the middle of the night. I learned not to do that.
Yeah.
It's in airplane mode. I will never take it out of airplane
mode.
So
you can't get an emergency call in the middle?
No.
Do you have a landline?
No.
So
if someone dies,
that would
I won't.
Me, yeah, that
I
would make me.
That, so you can get an emergency call in the middle of the night?
No, I've also just tried to like build a life where just like nobody calls me. Like I just don't.
No, I had this moment.
Calls,
it was a while ago. It was a few years ago, and I was working at the Times, and I remember I used to keep my phone. I went through this phase where at first I kept it next to my bed on, and so
yeah.
if someone texted me, I would wake up and see it, and then
you
I was
get
like,
in a. Does your phone make a sound when you get a text?
It did. It used
okay.
to. Right. This is back, you know, 5 years ago, and then I put it on silent, and then like there would be times, you know, just anxious, I would wake up and I would look at my phone and I would read my emails.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself one night, I got an email that was like a terrible email with someone like saying something terrible at something
yeah.
I'd written or whatever. I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to deal with this in the morning with my editor. And then the next night I got another email and it was like it was a good email and I was so excited. And in both instances, in the negative one and the positive one, I couldn't fall back asleep. And
yeah,
I was
sure.
thinking to myself, like, there is not a scenario on planet Earth where it will help me sleep by looking at my emails, whether
sure.
it's a good one or a bad one. And since then I stopped doing that. And gradually I've kind of eventually gotten to the point where it goes into airplane mode, and if someone dies, then I'll find out in the morning.
Yeah.
But
what
know,
if it's one of those emergency things like a tornado's coming or it's an earthquake? Wouldn't you want to get
I will
that?
Feel the earthquake.
That's true.
I don't think we get tornadoes in Los Angeles yet.
Okay, but one of those, a tsunami is coming.
A tsunami is coming. Luckily, I'm a little bit further inland.
Okay.
I can't think of any others. But, you know, look,
yeah.
there's a...
Fire.
There's a alien invasion.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to think about taking my phone out of airplane mode. No, but I think that what I find so fascinating is that is that we develop technologies and then we rely on the technologies to find a solution.
Yes.
You know,
we should just use the technology less.
Yes.
Yes, like, of course.
I'm curious if you think that how this is going to play out in the future. Like, I read a book last week about how we are going to meld with machines. Like, mm-hmm. essentially, the next era of all this stuff is like us becoming somewhat cyborgian, right? And part of me, I remember thinking to myself, like, oh, that's kind of cool. I'll be able to speak Japanese and probably like kung fu fight and stuff like that. But what happens if I like want to go into airplane mode? Like, how will that work? And I'm just curious, like, in the interim before we become cyborgs, of course, is this a human problem or a technological problem?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really know, but I do think the solution is probably willpower. If willpower is what is the issue, the solution has got to be willpower. It's not technology that compensates for it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just don't think the phone, if the phone is causing the problem, how can the phone be the solution to the problem? And I think that's true for all the things. I think you maybe even wrote about, there's that new email software that you have to pay for that everyone's very excited about. I don't know. It's some like, I shouldn't.
The one that like tells you, that helps organize your inbox and tells you what's important and what's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if you use those, they're garbage.
Yeah. But like, the solution is just to like use your email less.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, in Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
So here's a question. We are living in a time, and you and I have spoken about this before, your last book, Conspiracy, was, of course, about Peter Thiel and the media and this, that, and the other. And we're living in this era where we have this constant anxiety around mass shootings, what Donald Trump said this week, China, all these things. And one of the things that I think has been pretty amazing with technology is our ability to get access to the news instantly, mm-hmm. which is also comes with a number of downsides. How is your media habit, and how do you kind of, what do you recommend for people to do in those instances?
So I had this moment. So my the election of Donald Trump sent my wife into labor. Hmm. So my son was born like the next day. We went to bed thinking like, oh, this is, maybe we're going to eke this thing out, you know? And then she woke up at like 3 a.m. and was watching the news. And then she woke me up and she's like, this is not good. And I think I need to go to the hospital. And so he was born the next day. And I remember I was reading an article, like, you know, after you have a kid, you're kind of just sitting there as you don't really have anything to do. And they bring the baby in and out. And anyways, I was reading some article. It was somebody who I had listened to, and by the way, I was totally wrong because I didn't think he was going to win, but I was reading some article from someone who I'd read the week before telling me how this was never going to happen, who was turning around to tell me exactly what the election of Donald Trump meant.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just had like this moment. I was like, why the fuck am I listening to this person?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
why am I listening to someone's opinion who was so clearly just very wrong about this major thing? And I just said, like, I'm going to start consuming way less news. And so a couple things I do, like, I don't watch any television news. The only television news I watch is sometimes we watch the local news at home.
That's impressive.
Because, and actually I find this is almost harder to do than to be not on your phone. Like, because like when I travel a lot and I was doing, do you know that CNN pays airports to play CNN?
Does not surprise me.
And it's like even a special edition of CNN. Like they don't run like really particularly violent stories, and they never show anything about like anything airline related. and definitely not crashes. But like it's like sometimes when you remove something from your diet, whether it's media or food, you realize just like how dependent you were on it. Like when I'll tell you a social media one after this, but it was like being away from it. And then when I can see that I can't even sit in a chair at the airport facing the direction of a TV, even if I'm doing something, because like it manages I have to actually work to avoid it in my life. If I'm sitting in a restaurant, I have to find somewhere where I don't watch the news. The other revealing one for me is like at the beginning of this year, I have this thing called Daily Stoic, and we do these challenges. And we did a challenge where it was like, you have to quit one habit. And so I was like, I'm going to quit Facebook. And so I quit Facebook, except because of the community, we have this like Facebook group for Daily Stoic. So I was like, I can't quit this because like people paid to be in it. So I was like, I have to find some way to, basically I just changed the password on my Facebook account and gave it to an assistant. And then I created a new Facebook account with no friends and no likes that's only in this one group. So it's like more like a message board than Facebook, right? Yeah. But this is like a new account on a new email address in which I've entered almost no personal information. And Facebook is like, do you want to be friends with Steve, the kid you grew up with? Like,
completely. Like, no, Facebook is terrifying. I was doing some research and I created an Instagram account on a completely different phone.
Yes.
With a completely made up email address. And there was literally no way that they could have known it was me. It was a burner phone.
Yeah.
And they knew it was me.
Yes.
And they started recommending my wife and other people. And it's like, it's terrifying.
Yeah. Like yesterday it recommended that I be friends with my book agent. Like that's not like my parents. That's a pretty like.
You should be friends with your book agent.
I don't want any friends with the thing. And I'm friends with him in real life. But anyways, it was like, oh, like you just real, like this, like someone was telling me when I moved to Austin, they're like, you're going to eat a lot of queso, right? Like, because they put it on everything in Austin. They're like, if you want to stop eating queso, make queso one time and you'll see what's in it and you will never put this in your body. It's because it's like all oil. It's two cups of oil. And so it was like, it was actually very helpful to just
did
to see
how
trend.
Did you make the queso?
I did make it and I was like, I will never eat
queso again.
Yeah. And so seeing, it was like just the extent of the manipulation and the surveillance, it was like, this cannot be a healthy thing to participate in. And so I haven't used Facebook since January.
So let me ask you a question. So I'm going to ask you to come into my life and my house and help me make my life more still.
Got it.
You're in charge.
Okay. Do you watch a lot of news?
I don't watch a lot, but I fucking read so much news. It's awful.
So for me, I switched from like television news. I just watch sports. Like I don't really care that much about sports.
But it's like interesting sports
because it's just as much trivia and it has as little impact on my actual life as the news does. Right. And so like, if I'm going to have the TV on, I'm going to be watching sports. I'm not going to watch news. I'm not going to watch The Daily Show. I'm not going to watch Real Time with Bill Maher. I'm not going to watch anything that is deliberately around and getting me to have an opinion about things.
Do you think is that good for me or bad for me?
I think it's very good to consume those things
or to not consume less.
I think it's very much good for you. And then you go, oh, but I have to participate. I have to be informed.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
Let's read books about history. Like, how about you don't watch CNN, but you read the Bob Woodward book? It's not quite history, but it's at least real journalism, and you're at least not consuming it in real time. So you have some distance from it. Things have somewhat shaken themselves out. I think the problem is we consume way too much information in real time. And
real-time information is incorrect information most of the time.
By definition, usually. And you almost never make real-time action.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. So it's the end of the day.
Yes.
Put the kids down. I'm like so tired, can barely even think.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I end up like scrolling through dumb social media.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like my brain can't actually.
Your willpower, I think, is lessened as you get through
the
day.
Well, it's also like I can't just sit there.
Yeah.
Maybe I should. Maybe you're going to tell me as my therapist now, my stillness therapist, that I should sit there. But I have this kind of this moment where I'm like, well, what should I do with the next hour? And sometimes I try to read a book and
but you're fried.
But I'm fried and I can't concentrate. And I read the same page four times over. What do I do with my time?
I'm partial to Law and Order reruns.
So you watch TV.
I've made my way back through The Office. You know, I watch things that I don't come out of the other side less happy as a human being.
Mm.
But what I would say is, so the end of the day is important, but like I'd say, like, how do we think about the beginning of the day so we can, even if we do slum it at the end of the day, we've done what we want to do, and we've had some of that still. So,
that was my next question is I have this urge constantly to check my email.
Yes,
I hate it,
sure.
And I try not to. But like if I'm writing, I don't procrastinate a lot.
You're switching over tabs.
I'm really good at not procrastinating.
Yeah.
I get a tremendous amount done during the day from the minute I wake up until that time that I have an hour left of the day and can't concentrate anymore.
Yeah.
But there are these like fly-by moments where I quickly pop over to my email. What's going on there? And how do I stop?
I mean, I definitely have that too. And I would say it's objectively, we know it's not good. We know that we're not. The studies show we're not good at switching between tasks, even though we think that we are. So I try to limit it. I try to just not have the tab open. Do you know what I mean? Like if I don't have the tab open, I can't switch to it. I want to have maybe the phone is face down, the phone is in the other room. But here's how I do it. So when I wake up early. I try to wake up before my kids, but they wake up so early, sometimes you can't beat them.
Yep.
And so what I do is I take, because we still have a newborn who sleeps a little bit later, but for the last 2 years, I take my son on a walk in the morning. And I don't take my phone.
Wow.
So where
do you go? Do you just walk?
We just walk outside. Like he sits in the stroller. Sometimes I do the backpack, but mostly the stroller. And we'll do between like 2 and 3 miles.
And so, you don't have a phone with you?
Don't have
Does
a phone.
Does that give you any anxiety?
No, not really. I mean, I'm only 2 miles from my house, so so we walk. We watch the sun come up. We talk. He sings songs. You know, we look at deer that we see or rabbits. You know, we're just outside. And then by the time I come home, I found it's interesting on days when I don't take him for the walk, not only do I miss it, but I find he's crazier.
Hmm.
Like somehow it's the experience is calming for him as I can.
Of course, it's nature. It's.
And it's just the routine of it.
Yeah.
And then so I do that. Then we cook breakfast. I let him watch TV in the morning. I don't really care. I'm not like a no screen parent kind of person. We make breakfast. And then the next thing I do is I write in a journal. Like I want to spend some time. Like I sort of warm up to writing. And then I write. So like by 8:30, I'm usually into the writing. And if I can go to like 11:30, like the day's a success.
Then you can check it, and you don't feel like you've missed anything.
I can check it. I don't feel like I missed it. Maybe I glanced at the email a couple times to make sure there's no emergencies. But I'm not checking the phone. I'm not trying to get to inbox zero in the morning. I'm trying mostly to get as deep into the writing as quickly as possible.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
And if you are watching this video. Either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
So your book is split up into three sections, mind, body, and soul. What are, first of all, why pick those things? But second of all, what were some of the things that you discovered that were kind of eye-opening as you do? I know you go deep in your research and like you do a lot of reading about history and whatnot. Talk us through some of that.
Well, I just think there are different kinds of stillness. So there are people who might, you know, live a very quiet, still life. You know, they it's very disciplined, but they're, you know, emotionally sort of in turmoil all the time. Or there's someone like Tiger Woods who clearly has this sort of mental discipline in the game of golf, but like spiritually and emotionally, like it must have been horrible. Like Thich Nhat Hanh, his thing is like on the ocean and the surface of the ocean, there's stillness, but underneath it, there are currents. Mm. I think that so I think just this idea that like, oh, you know, clear your mind is like, that's not going to get you where you need to go. You have to attack this thing from a bunch of angles. And then ironically, I do find active things like walking or running, or I find swimming to be a deeply meditative experience. So there, what do you do in the real world? What are the habits that you build in the real world? My favorite part of writing the book, I did a big thing on Winston Churchill. Like Churchill wrote a book about painting. And he was saying that like the most important thing that a powerful person can do is cultivate a few hobbies. And then he was like, the hobbies are what creates the balance. And the Romans talked about, you know, the power of leisure, not leisure as in laying around, but leisure as in like, what do you pursue in your off time?
I just read this book. It's probably piled up over here somewhere, but I've read a bunch of books lately by Alan Lightman, who's this MIT professor, and he's a scientist and he's in the humanities department, and he's written, I think, maybe 12, 13 books, and I think like six of them are all about the idea of creativity and stillness. Mm-hmm. And the importance of the best way to be creative is not to just go and, you know, draw and sketch and try to make a music album or write a book, but is to sit and do nothing.
Sure.
And that your brain kind of almost like a snow globe settles, and the results, of course, speak for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, so in the morning, that's my routine, and then in the afternoon, I run or I swim. I tend to find that like just popping into my head are solutions to whatever like creative problems I was having in the writing. Like, I'll be, oh, that's what that chapter should be titled, or like, oh, that's. Yeah. This is the story that I should tell in that chapter.
Hmm. Aaron Sorkin takes, I think, like 6 to 8 showers a day when he gets stuck.
Really?
Yeah, he just literally is like, because I think there's this whole thing on like this whole Zen theory about, you know, about certain people hitting enlightenment in like those moments,
sure.
like on the toilet or showering, and it's this, there's something about the stillness of that moment that brings that on.
I think that's part of it. I also think like rituals and routines are important. So like, you know, like Robert Caro dresses in a suit and he goes to work. I don't do that, but like I have trouble writing well and feeling like I'm doing it right if I don't shower and shave.
Hmm.
Like I just need the cleanness of it. I can do it. Like I can gut it out, or if it's busy, you know what I mean. If
but
it's
no,
busy,
you need that. But that ritual is important.
But I like it. Yeah.
You were saying Robert Caro was he the guy who used to wear a suit to his home office?
I think he has an office in New York City.
Some famous writer who would literally wake up every morning and like go through this whole ritual of like a piece of toast, half buttered, half jam, blah, 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 blah. Puts on a suit, walks out to the lawn, comes into his office,
works
all day, and then heads back. I've always admired that because it's like, it puts you in a mindset. I remember actually, when I wrote the Twitter book, I was having a really hard time jumping from Twitter to New York Times columns and reporting and things like that. And I would be writing, might write in one style and had to switch to another because the book was very narrative nonfiction. And the Times, of course, you have to write in the Times style. And I remember I was having such a hard time. I called up a neuroscientist, I think at Stanford. And I was like, what do I do? And he told me that your setting and the scent and the chair and all these things all contribute to how your mind places things and how you work. And his suggestion was, if you live in a house with more than one place to sit at a computer, he said put a scented can, two different scented candles, like one in one room, one in another, two different kinds of chairs, one with a cushion, one without, even like change your shirt or something, and that your brain can say, oh, I'm in this setting and I'm in that setting.
Yeah, the poet Rilke had like two pens and two different kinds of paper on his desk, and like one was for poems and the other was for letters. And like I like that. And there's like a there's this group of monks. They do like, and someone sent me it's like this incense you rub on your hands and then sniff before you pray or meditate. So I love those things. And look, I think sports where that the performance is like the most measurable and the pressure is the highest, I don't think it's a coincidence that they have, they are very routine and ritual based. And there's actually this baseball player, I talk about it a little bit in the book, there's this baseball player, I'm forgetting his name, but after he played...
I have it right here.
Oh, Sadaharu.
Yeah, Sadaharu.
He's amazing, and definitely people should know more about him. That's not who I was going to say.
But okay.
Sadaharu was the greatest home run hitter of all time, better than Babe Ruth. He hit like 1,000 home runs, but he played in Japan, not in America. But this baseball player, after he played for a couple of years, then he went back to college and got his PhD in psychology, and so he was fascinated with routines and rituals, and he wrote this paper on the power of ritual in sports and in life. And he was looking at some tribe, some ocean tribe, and they would find that there was more, so like if we can think there's a vast difference between fishing in a lagoon and fishing in the open ocean. In a lagoon, it's primarily a matter of skill, because like the fish are there and they can't go anywhere. So it's like, how good are you at catching them? And then in the ocean, it's like, you don't know where the fish are. So it's much more like, did you go to the right spot on the right day at the right time? Right. So there's like, you can go out, fish all day in the ocean, come back with nothing. It's not your fault. You fish all day in the lagoon, you're probably not doing something right. Right. And so anyways, they were finding that these tribes tended to have more superstitions and rituals about fishing where luck was more at play than where it wasn't. Do you know what I mean? Because like we're just trying to find some way to like get comfortable with the uncertainty of it and to, you know, predispose the gods in our favor or whatever. And so the idea is that sports and life are so uncertain. You know, you sit down at the computer, you don't really control whether it's going to be a good writing day or not. And that some of these rituals are just a way to sort of calm that, you know, animal part of your brain that just like can't handle the uncertainty.
Do you, has your relationships changed with like your wife, your kids? I mean, you said you go for walks with your kid, but has this new control of the inputs changed those?
I think so. I mean, I think on the practical level it gives you more time. I mean, I think where I hope it's manifesting itself is like my anxiety can sort of manifest itself in like a desire to control, right? So it's like, okay, we got to be at the airport. And I don't want to miss the flight. So like, let's leave early. And then if I'm very stressed and mean, it will somehow like help us get there. You know what? Like, you know how people get when they have
course.
To go.
Yeah, yeah.
And
get
and,
the fucking car.
Right. Yeah. Brian Koppelman said that told me his family, there's like airport Brian.
Oh, there's airport Brian. That's amazing.
And I was like, I
there's
remember
definitely
heard
airport
that.
Nick.
I was like, I don't want to have an airport Ryan. There definitely is one, but I definitely don't want to be, but just the idea of going like, Even the last couple of days, I've been running around like crazy all over LA doing stuff. And it's like, can I just be like, this is the day. Like the day is I have to be here, then I have to be here, then I have to be here.
So when you're running around like crazy, do you like go back to your hotel and just sit there? Do you have a moment where you kind of recreate this like stillness?
Well, so what I used to do is I would go like, okay, so these are the three things that I have to do, the three interviews I have to do, or the three meetings I have to go to. And I'd be like, and I still have to do all of the normal stuff that I would do in a day. So I basically, instead of being like, today is a lost day because I have to do these three things, I'm just going to do it. I agreed to it. I signed up for it. It is what it is. Instead, I would add this extra pressure on myself. It's like, and then I got to squeeze in emails between these two things. And then I got to try to find a way to meet this person. And then I got to do this. You know what I mean? Like I couldn't just go like, this is it. Like I couldn't accept that the day was not in my control. I had to like somehow get it to my normal level of productivity despite all these massive inconveniences. And I just didn't have a problem. It's like something, there has to be a cost there somewhere. And I was like, the relationships are where the cost is. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, don't have time to be nice. Don't have time to be polite. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like,
completely.
Like, or I'd be like, well, I can't be stressed at the meeting, but the stress has to go somewhere. So like, let's like dump steam. It in the safe space, in the safest place. And so I think to me, one of the manifestations of the stillness would be the ability to let go a little bit and be not in control and just being cool, taking it as it goes.
When you look at the, you have kids. Yes. How many kids do you have?
Two
kids. And we live in a time right now where there's climate change that's happening. You mentioned tornadoes before in LA. We haven't had them yet, but I'm sure it's going to happen.
Yeah,
you get them to Texas. You'll probably have tidal waves in Texas at some point. If things continue down the path, you've got Donald Trump in the White House, driving division, racism, you've got mass shootings, you've got all these things that are coming at you and us. And I feel partially, like, one thing I find really fascinating is I rag on social media all the time and how much of a waste of time it is and how annoying it is and how there's always an earthquake and sometimes it's an important one and sometimes it's them just, going after someone that said something by accident or whatever. But at the same time, like, here's an example this week. There was a really dumb headline in the New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times, and there was an uproar in social media. And the Times changed the headline on the front page. And Dean Baquet, the editor-in-chief, came out and did an interview and apologized. And there's a whole thing they're going to change now about reviewing the headline. And there was an impact. You know, you can see with the response to the mass shootings that Trump came out and he gave a pathetic speech. But it was a speech nonetheless that was that didn't blame both sides, even though he did it later. Yeah. But the reason I bring this all up is because having a level of engagement, even if it gives us some sort of anxiety, is important.
Sure.
It's our civil duty. Mm-hmm. So how do you find the balance with that?
Yeah. So a couple of things. So I did this thing a couple months ago where I read like the front page of the New York Times like on my birthday, like the day I was born, and then like 10 years. I just went back and I was looking at it. And then it was very calming because it was like, it's never been good. Like it's never like a wonderful headline. Like it's never a wonderful front page.
If it bleeds, it leads.
It's just always, the world is always falling apart and it always looks really bad. I'm reading this book right now about like the passage of the 19th Amendment. Like it's called like the Finest Hour, or the Women's Hour, about like giving women the right to vote. Like I literally, we talk about division. Like, I knew it was hard to get women the right to vote because I just thought, like, men didn't want to give women the right to vote. I didn't know there was, like, a very engaged, they called them antis, but there was a very engaged, almost majority of women who did not want to give other women the right to vote. Like, that doesn't seem like a content. I thought that was a men versus women issue. It was like, no, it was like men versus some women versus men, mostly women versus women. Like, it was insane. Just reading, like, you're reading this thing and you're like, oh man, like, this idea that history has ever been peaceful or nice or that things have ever been going well is insane. And I think my reading from history helps me calm down. Like, I was reading a book about Henry Clay. Henry, like, we think Trump is, like, violating all these norms. Like, Henry Clay was elected senator and sat as a senator, I think it's Henry Clay, even though he was objectively too young to be a senator. Like, you have to be a certain age.
Yeah.
And he was, like let's say it's 30, and he was, like, 28. And he was like, no, I'm still going to do it. And people did it. Like, so we have this idea that, like, the rules used to work, and now they're not working. And I'm not saying they are working now or that they're not working worse. What I'm saying is that it helped turn down the volume just enough, not that I don't think about it, but that I don't get as easily riled up as, like, let's say Twitter wants you to get.
Mm-hmm.
And I did this piece a couple weeks ago where I was talking about, when you really look at most of these, most of the people who have been able to affect really big change, anger is not the primary way you would describe them. They have a sort of a deeper mission or understanding or sort of outlook. Like Lincoln was probably the least angry person about slavery, but was the one that got, not that he wasn't profoundly bothered by slavery and that it wasn't a driving, ending it wasn't a driving force in his life, but he did not wake up every day outraged that slavery existed. He woke up thinking that it was wrong and it needed to be stopped, but that there was something that could be done about it. So I guess what I'm saying is, and I talk a lot about anger in the book, we have wrongly internalized or been sold this idea that like anger is the force through which political change is driven. And that's most people, if you ask them how they feel about things, they say anger. And I would argue that's probably why things are so gridlocked.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I was on social media yesterday doing some research, and my social media time has dropped dramatically, especially Twitter. But I was on Twitter looking something up for a project I'm working on, and I saw a Kellyanne Conway tweet, and it was referring to the mass shootings. And she was tweeting that one of the shooters had some left-leaning social media posts.
Yeah. Mm.
She hadn't tweeted about the guy who had the right-leaning pro-Trump social media posts. Yeah. But it made my blood boil. Like, I literally...
Because it's actively said in bad faith.
Yes. And it just... And I sat there and I felt what George Conway probably feels every single night when he goes home to that woman. But it just made, and then I was like, I need to do something. I have to do something. What do I do? And then I realized, oh, there's fuck all I can do other than vote. And I can write articles, of course, but that act of
I think about how blinding that feeling is. Like, you know, it consumes you. And so, yeah, I think that's the purpose of it.
The purpose of her tweet.
I don't think she just said it because she's dumb. I think there's an entire sort of, maybe it's unspoken, maybe they all get together and coordinate it, but I think there is a right-wing idea that like what we have to do is just rile the libs up and they will defeat themselves. I think I think Trump knows this implicitly. I think that's, they go, what can we say on, like when I pull up Twitter and, because I do it on the desktop, you know, there's the thing running down the side of the trending topics. And
yep.
Every once in a while I'll have a lapse of willpower and I'll click one and it'll be like sports stuff or things you wouldn't think are mad. And then like, you know, there's the some funny gifs, and then it's like mostly people that I know in journalism or people whose work in journalism I follow just like angrily responding or dunking or like, it's, you know, I
no, like, it's, yeah.
I think that might be what they do all day because it's like right after it happened.
Yeah. I have stopped tweeting for the most part. Maybe once every 3 weeks I'll post something. Usually the thing that I can't stop myself is immigration and kids.
Yes, of course.
That's something it's horrible. It's the most vile, disgusting thing imaginable. But there was I've done the same thing with the trending topics. There was a thing yesterday about after the Kellyanne Conway thing, I saw Michael Cera was trending, and I was like, oh, what's Michael Cera trending for? Is he dead? You know, I clicked on it, and the first tweets are like, you know, there's a couple of funny GIFs of him from movies and things like that. And then somebody had said, why is Michael Cera trending? And someone else had replied, oh, no one knows, but people saw him like trending on a local level and they decided to make it a national thing. So people start tweeting. And then next thing you know, it's Michael Cera in relation to Donald Trump. And you're like, how the hell did this happen? I just wasted 10 minutes of my life. And now I'm angry because I saw Kellyanne Conway tweet.
And what I don't really get about, it's like, look, I don't like sort of clickbaity journalism, but I understand people get paid for it. So I at least understand. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't get what these people are. I don't get why these people are doing it. Like, you get the followers, but like, they're not worth anything.
It's not worth it. No, it's totally not worth it in any way, shape, or form.
And I have some friends that do cable news too, and I was like, oh, you get paid for this? And they're like, no. And I was like, do you sell books because of it? And they're like, no. And I was like, And every time I've done it, it's like you have to take a car to a studio and it's remote. And then it's like 3 seconds and you're like, why did I do this? But like, I think at the core of this, a lot of it is ego and impotence. And
well, so that's a question I have is, so you are astutely aware of how the media industry works better than most people I know. And I feel that the media over the last few years has become social media-ified, where it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And you talk about the intent by like Kellyanne Conway and Trump to own the libs. Like, it's the same CNN, MSNBC, Fox. They all are just kind of trying to wrap you up and get you emotionally hooked, and that's it. It's one thing for us to be at war with our devices and the technologies and learn to kind of walk away from them, but there's also a responsibility for the technology makers too.
Of course.
Is there a solution that in the media world that you can foresee, or anything that helps the consumer so they're not?
Yeah, you know more about Twitter than I do. I don't get why algorithmically they can't just like turn down politics. Like, it feels like it's like this dinner party. You know, like at a dinner party, you can have all these people with different viewpoints. If you're talking about kids or, you know, the town you could talk about anything, it's great. But then if somebody mentions politics, and this is true well before Donald Trump, now all of a sudden there's like conflict. And so like the job of the host is to be like, yeah, Nick, don't you have a book coming out? And you know, like to change to like,
I don't
I used to remember people talking about pizza on Twitter and memes and jokes. I mean, like, I feel like, and if you look for it, like there's great sports Twitter and there's like some meme Twitter, but like why is Instagram so much more pleasant than Twitter?
Well, Instagram's more pleasant than Twitter because it's a more visual medium. But I also think that I don't think that Instagram makes the world any better of a place than Twitter.
It doesn't make the world as worse of a place.
Yeah, I agree completely.
But I don't get why algorithmically they can't do things.
They could,
about
but it. If they did, then you would. You know, I think that the reason you hate scroll through it. You know,
it's, yes.
But I think the larger problem I have is with the media as a whole, where everything is now an opinion piece and
sure.
And you know, it's the thing that I find so frustrating and now has become the thing about everything. It's like, I even hate to mention his name, but like Ben Shapiro thinks that like, you know, the way you win a fight is you find the one little thing you don't understand, the one detail that you missed. Maybe right. It was like the person was 22 years old, not 23. Ah, I gotcha. Yes. I win.
Right.
It's so fucking stupid. Like, and that's what all of this media coverage is about with every single thing. It's like some commenter, some pundit arguing a tiny detail that's irrelevant, and that makes them think that they've won.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I think where the media has hurt themselves by focusing so much on Twitter is that, like, your entire profession, the entire profession of a writer it's a long form profession. Like, it's detail and nuance, and it's entertaining the reader. It's getting them to go from the beginning of the article to the end of the article. It's understanding that things are complicated and the story needs to be told. And so to spend, if that's what you do as your job, but then you spend 90% of the time you're at work trying to express yourself in 280 characters, you are not only letting that skill atrophy, but you're sort of doing the opposite. Like Socrates was considered wise because he was like aware of his own ignorance. Like, Twitter does not have any room for admissions of ignorance, mm-hmm. or humility or nuance. And so I think these issues are very complex. Like, as horrible as children being put in cages on the southern border are, that doesn't mean the solution to it is like, okay, not doing that is very simple. Like, yes. that is morally reprehensible, should not be happening, and anyone that's complicit in it is awful. That being said, the actual solution to the issue at large is quite complicated.
Yes,
and nuanced.
I agree with that completely.
And we have to have that discussion or debate somewhere. And what I think we not only lack the wisdom and the emotional strength to have that, we don't even literally have the space to do it. Because what media, like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, I think Daniel Boorstin talks about this in his book, The Image. He's like, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. First off, there was like 8 of them. They eat, like, one got up and talked for 2 hours, then the other got up for 2 hours, then they took a break, then everyone went home, and then they came back in the afternoon and they did like another 4 hours. Like, it was like insane. Mm-hmm. But that's because the expansion of slavery was a super complex issue, because it was expressly allowed in the Constitution, and there was who had the votes. You know what? It was like, we had to figure it out. And so two smart people with very different views hammered it out for hours in a very eloquent way. And by the way, like, town folk and farmers in Illinois walked, like, you know, made their way there, and they sat, like, we don't have the space to do any of those things. You go on cable news, they're like, in 30 seconds, tell me why Donald Trump is going to be impeached.
30 seconds is a long time when you're a pundit. Yeah. No, it's completely true. I think, I think that, you know, to bring this back around to the beginning, I think that it's not just people that could use a little bit of this stillness. It's like, it's all of it. It's everything.
Yes.
It's businesses, it's the media, it's technology, it's you name it.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, last question.
Okay.
And then we're going to let you go. Do you have you had one piece of advice, just one, that I could like take with me after you leave?
Yes.
What is it? What's the one thing that I should do?
All right, I'll give you this. I think this will do it.
Okay. Right, so reaching into his pocket.
I carry this coin with me.
Okay. I've been given a coin.
I think this will help with your mindless scrolling and the anger, which is like, if we can remember how little time we actually have on the planet.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so Marcus Aurelius's quote, it's on the back of the thing. He says, you can leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think. And so this idea that, like, you want to spend your last 20 minutes on Earth, like, mindlessly scrolling this, or that you want to be angry about something that, you know, 100 years from now, no one will even think about. Like, to me, it's like, I try to think about this and spend a lot of time on it, and it helps me go, like, okay, I'm on my phone. I know I shouldn't be. And then my son's saying, like, Daddy, Daddy, come look at this. And I'm going, oh, be right there. It's like, no. I'm going to put this down right now. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's something I use, and I think philosophically has been used for a really long time, to bring us always back to the present and to turn down the volume on, not just the volume on, like, the noisy things we don't like, but also turn down the volume on, like, some of the things that we think of as virtues, but, like, you know, like, wanting to sell more books than other people, or wanting to hit the bestseller list, or, like, I gotta get this amount of money for this book, or, you know, like, just, like, our ambitions are wonderful, and they help do things, and they're why, you know, we're both sitting here, but at the same time is also the source of a lot of the misery that we also have. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, completely. 1000% completely agree.
Like, he has this line, he goes, like, Alexander the Great and his mule driver are, like, buried right next to each other. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The same ground, like, at the end of the road, we all end up in the same fucking place. And that's not to say you should be a nihilist, that none of this matters, that you shouldn't try to realize your potential or do things. It's just like, it's not as important. None of this is as important as it feels.
Well, that's a good piece of closing advice. With that, your 19th book, Stillness is the Key. Ryan Holiday, thank you so much for taking the time today. This has been fantastic. I really am actually going to try to do all this stuff. Tomorrow I'm traveling. Okay. On Saturday morning,
okay,
I'm going to get up with the kids and I'm going to take 10 minutes before I look at my phone.
Okay.
And I will let you know how it goes.
Done.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Thanks to my guest today, Ryan Holiday. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors this week, the wonderful Quip and the New Yorker. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll see you next week.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.